Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, President Trump has issued a flurry of executive orders in the last 2 weeks. Our form of government gives him that right, but what can and can't such orders do? The answer?
It depends. Sometimes it's the Constitution that gives the president that power. And sometimes it's Congress via statutory delegations of power where Congress hands away power to the president. But regardless, our president in our country is not a king, right? He doesn't have a magic make it happen wand. Instead, all of his executive orders, if they're to have legal effect, they have to be grounded in some sort of legal authority, flowing from the Constitution or flowing from statutes. And if they are based in a legitimate source of legal authority, then they're legally binding. They can have the same legal effect as statutes.
That's UW law professor Catherine Watts. She and a panel of her law school colleagues met recently to discuss the many ways the Trump administration might change how government works. The University of Washington School of Law and Town Hall Seattle sponsored this event, Presidential Power in 2017, on February 1st. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the complete discussion and other great talks on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Town Hall Seattle's Katie Sewell introduces the event.
I would like to introduce Dean Kelly Testy to the stage. Kelly is the Tony Rembry Dean and Professor of Law at the University of Washington School of Law, which she has led since 2009. She is the immediate past president of the Association of American Law Schools. During her term as president, Dean Testy's theme was Why Law Matters. And recently, she was named the second most influential legal educator by the National Jurist. Please join me in welcoming Dean Kelly Testy.
Well, good evening, and thank you, Katie, for that kind introduction, and thank you for inviting us to Town Hall. We also want to thank your entire team, especially Ashley, for all the help in putting this program together. And the University of Washington School of Law couldn't be any prouder to be here tonight to talk about the rule of law in our world right now. Our nation is one committed to the rule of law, which is designed to promote some stability during times of transition and change. And indeed to support peaceful, a prosperous, and a very just society. And that's the goal that we have as lawyers. And at UW Law School, we educate leaders for the global common good. That's our mission. And while our reach is certainly around the globe, our feet are firmly planted in Washington State, and we aim to be of service to this community and very much value our role as a public law school devoted to assisting our community with learning about issues that matter. So tonight we're very pleased to be here to discuss a nonpartisan issue that is the top of every newscast and above the fold in every newspaper. And that topic is, what is within the scope of the authority of a president? Now, I am as interested as you are to hear from my distinguished colleagues tonight, and so I want to introduce them to you. To my immediate left is Professor Lisa Manheim, and Professor Manheim will be the moderator tonight and will join me at the podium in just a moment. I want to let you know that she is an expert in election law, so pretty on point for tonight. And in addition to previously practicing law, Professor Manheim served as a clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court. Moving down the row, I want to introduce Professor Catherine Watts, who holds the Jack McDonald Endowed Chair at UW Law School and is one of our nation's leading experts on presidential power in the administrative state. She's been a little busy lately answering questions. Among many professional activities and honors, I also want to let you know that Professor Watts was also a clerk on the U.S. Supreme Court, serving for Justice John Paul Stevens. Next to her is Professor Trevor Gardner. Following his graduation from Harvard Law School, he worked as a trial attorney for the District of Columbia Public Defender Service, and later obtained master's and doctoral degrees in sociology from UC Berkeley. He is an expert in criminal justice with a focus on policing. Next to Trevor is Professor Angelica Chazaro, a graduate of Columbia Law School and an expert in immigration law. Professor Chazaro previously worked with the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project in Seattle, and there she specialized in representing immigrant survivors of violence and also representing farm workers. Next to her is Professor Sally Sanford, an expert in healthcare law, including the Affordable Care Act. Professor Sanford began her career as a law clerk for Judge Robert Beazer of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. She served then as an assistant attorney general representing the UW Medical Center, Harborview Medical Center, and the UW's Health Sciences Schools. And at the end of the line here, last but certainly not least, is my colleague, Professor Bob Anderson. He is a professor at UW Law and directs our Native American Law Center. He's an expert in American Indian law, natural resource law, and environmental law. Professor Anderson also served in the Department of the Interior in the 90s and was co-chair of President Obama's transition team for the Interior in 2008. I will be back to moderate the Q&A after our panel has made their presentation. At this time, I'm delighted to welcome to the podium Professor Lisa Manheim. Again, thank you.
So thank you, Kelly, and thank you to everyone for coming. So here's the question I have for our panel. Why does it seem like sometimes the president can't get anything done, but other times it seems like the president can do anything he wants simply with a stroke of the pen? The answer lies in the law of presidential power, and that law is confusing. That confusion, in turn, can be frustrating for people, and particularly for those who would like to get involved in the process and have their voices heard. Today's discussion is an attempt to respond to that confusion. It's an effort to help to shed light on the question of presidential power by looking more deeply into the question of what a president can do and what a president cannot do. We hope to demystify these sorts of laws and these sorts of restrictions in an effort to better understand what sort of constraints a president have. And we hope that this discussion demonstrates the following point. While it is, in fact, difficult to understand the legal limits on a president's power, that difficulty exists because the relevant laws are complicated, and not because those laws are random or non-existent. And as a result of these complicated but important restrictions, individuals really can have influence in politics through various forms of civic participation. So we'll be sure to leave a few minutes near the end of the program for questions from the audience. And we'll also be wrapping things up no later than 9 o'clock. So as you think about your questions, we would ask that you please try to be succinct, no more than a couple sentences. And the reason for that is that we would love to hear from a number of you, and also because we do have a lot to talk about tonight. To that end, let's start with Catherine, who is an expert in presidential powers. Catherine, President Trump has been quite busy in his first 2 weeks in office. Now, things that he says to the news, or things that he says on Twitter, that does not have legal effect. But by contrast, when he communicates through what are called executive orders, that does have legal effect, or at least it can. And one big recent example of this is the executive order that President Trump issued on Friday, which imposed the travel ban. So this all leads to the question, Catherine, what is an executive order, and why is a president allowed to issue them?
Sure, thanks, Lisa. Yes, the president has indeed been very busy signing a number of orders that touch on everything from building a wall, to putting a temporary freeze on regulations in our country, to instituting the travel ban that Lisa just mentioned, to freezing federal hiring. So what is an executive order exactly, Lisa asked. Our government, it's divided into three branches, as we know. There's the legislative branch that makes law, there's the judicial branch that interprets the law when deciding cases, and then there's the executive branch that enforces and executes the law. And sitting at the very top of that executive branch is the president. He sits atop a pretty massive executive branch. It has hundreds of federal agencies in it. It has more than 2 million federal employees within it. And about 4,000 of those are political appointees. So at its essence, an executive order is a communication tool. It's a signed document that the president can use to communicate his wishes to those that work underneath him within the executive branch. It's a communication tool to ask officers or to demand that officers do something or stop doing something. At its heart, that's what an executive order is. And they're not new. They've been issued throughout our country's history. All the way back to President George Washington, we saw orders being issued. Most of them are directed internally at internal government affairs or at government officials. And they don't have a direct impact on external actors, on private individuals. A good example of that, when President Clinton entered office, President Clinton signed an order that put into place various ethics standards to govern his political appointees. And President Trump recently signed a very similar ethics order that also put into place ethics standards to govern his executive officers. So these kinds of orders, orders that govern and speak to executive officials and their actions, they're really commonplace. And for the most part, they're not terribly controversial. But much more controversial are those orders that do have an impact on private individuals' lives, orders whose impact spills over into the private sphere. One particularly controversial example, I think, of such an order are memos that were issued during the Obama administration in the immigration arena, memos that tried to protect undocumented parents and children from deportation. Another example of something more on the controversial side is the travel ban that Lisa, you just mentioned. And so another piece of your question, Lisa, was not just what executive orders are, but what gives the president the power to issue these orders that can have such significant impact on people's lives with just the stroke of a pen. The answer, I guess not that surprisingly, as it often is in the law, is it depends. Sometimes it's the Constitution that gives the president that power. And sometimes it's Congress via statutory delegations of power where Congress hands away power to the president. But regardless, our president in our country is not a king, right? He doesn't have a magic make it happen wand. Instead, all of his executive orders, if they're to have legal effect, they have to be grounded in some sort of legal authority, flowing from the Constitution or flowing from statutes. And if they are based in a legitimate source of legal authority, then they're legally binding. They can have the same legal effect as statutes.
So are you saying that the president can, in effect, change the law simply by signing a piece of paper?
Yeah. Yes. In effect, even though I just told you the legislative branch is the branch that makes law, the president can make law, too, when he's been given the power to do that, when Congress has handed him that power, or when the Constitution vests that type of power in the president. To make it all a little bit more concrete, maybe I could mention briefly three concrete examples of orders that President Trump has signed and show you how they'll have different effects. And the reason they have different effects is because of the legal authority that many of them are based on. So the three that I think would be good examples. First, the order that directs the building of a wall. Second, an order that tells agencies that for every new regulation they want to come in the door and be put on the books, they need to take two existing regulations off the books. And then the third, contrasting example, the temporary travel ban. So let's talk briefly about the first, president's order directing the building of a border wall. So does President Trump, does he have the unilateral power to just with the stroke of a pen commit our country to building a wall along the entire border between the United States and Mexico, which spans nearly 2,000 miles? No, he really doesn't. And why not? Why doesn't he have that power? Well, because building a wall along the whole border would cost a whole lot of money. Right? Estimates show somewhere between $8 billion and $25 billion. And under our Constitution, the president does not control the purse strings. Who does? Congress controls the purse strings. So years ago, Congress did pass a statute that authorized the building of some barriers along small portions of the border. But if the president wants to build a wall along the entire border, then the president's going to need money, and will need money from Congress. Now, President Trump and his advisors, they certainly know this. So as a result, if you read the order, then you'll see that what it actually directs, it simply directs government officials to try their best to identify funding, to find money, and to develop budget requests from Congress for money. So in the end, this particular order, its legal impact is fairly limited in terms of the wall, but it certainly has significant communicative value, communicating to his officers, telling them to start taking steps, and also significant political effect, because it sends a strong signal to his supporters that he is following up on a key campaign promise. Contrast that with President Trump's two out, one in order. This is an order that says to federal agencies that regulate everything from the environment, from the air we're all breathing right now, to the safety of workplaces, tells federal agencies, if you want to make a new regulation, then you need to take two existing regulations off the books. So this order will have significant effect on federal executive agencies. Why? Because the heads of those agencies, they work for the president. They can be fired by the president. So they listen to the president. But does the order itself actually undo regulations that protect me and protect you and that impose obligations on all of us and impose obligations on businesses? No, the executive order itself doesn't undo regulations, and it can't undo the regulations. Rather, under law, taking away regulations, taking them off the books, that has to be done by the agencies. And it has to be done through a really lengthy and cumbersome process, one that we call notice and comment rulemaking. Sounds fancy, but really all it is a process that says all of us, everyone, has an opportunity to submit comments, to participate, and then the agency has to justify its decision based on the statute, based on regulatory scheme, based on scientific data, based on studies, and based on public comments. So in the end, the two out, one in order, it too doesn't have a huge amount of immediate legal impact. Sure, it has political value, communicative value. It tells his officers to start the process of undoing regulations, but the order itself doesn't undo regulations because the president doesn't have the power to do that. The law puts that power elsewhere. Now, contrast that example with the third, the travel ban. The travel ban, which bans travelers coming from seven predominantly Muslim countries, it obviously had immediate impact, significant impact, many would say severe impact, on families, on children, people across the globe. It resulted in detention at individuals at airports across our country. So that order, it indeed did much more than simply issue directions. It actually altered rights. President Trump believes that both the Constitution and various statutes give him the power to take that action in the name of national security. Others believe that the president exceeded his powers and acted in violation of the Constitution. So not surprisingly, given this dispute, lawsuits have already emerged across our country, including one actually that was just filed here in Seattle on Monday by the state of Washington. State of Washington took the lead, quick to file, and we will see how that unfolds. A hearing is taking place on Friday. Also earlier this week, many of you probably saw in the news, the acting Attorney General, Sally Yates, the head of the Department of Justice at the time, she was fired by President Trump, fired because she said that she would not defend the order in court. So given all the controversy, the legal controversy around this order, I expect that with time, these legal issues, they'll work their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, much as President Obama's actions in the immigration arena worked themselves up to the U.S. Supreme Court last year. The issues of presidential power here, they're that big. So hopefully comparing and contrasting those three examples helps to show you that not all executive orders are created equal in terms of their impact. Some mainly serve as communication tools or political tools. Others have real legal impact on the ground that you see immediately. And as Lisa said, the reason for that, it's not random or haphazard, but rather it turns on the wording and the scope of the order, and even more importantly, on the legal authority that the president's hanging his hat on when he signs that order with the stroke of a pen.
Thank you, Catherine. Now, when it comes to whether the president has the legal authority to do things, sometimes the president disagrees with some other party or person in the government, and a lawsuit will arise out of that. And you mentioned that Washington has filed a lawsuit along those lines. Now, that brings up, for at least me, the question of the announcement that President Trump made yesterday when he nominated Neil Gorsuch to the United States Supreme Court. One thing that some folks may be wondering is, if this judge is confirmed, will Judge Gorsuch, is he likely to just sign off on anything that President Trump does? For example, the travel ban?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, so it's impossible to predict what Judge Gorsuch will or won't do with respect to, for example, the travel ban. But I can say that it's safe to say that Judge Gorsuch, just like other federal judges, they don't just do what the president says to do just because the president told them so or just because the president appointed them. That's not how courts work. I remember watching a debate with my kids this fall, a presidential debate, where Trump at the time said that if he were elected, Roe versus Wade involving abortion would be overturned automatically. And I remember explaining to my kids that that's not how it works. Presidents don't get to overrule Supreme Court precedents interpreting the Constitution. Only Supreme Court justices get to do that. And when they do that, when they interpret the Constitution, federal judges decide cases based on their interpretation of the law, not the whims of the presidential winds, not their own personal policy preferences. Instead, they have to act based on the rule of law. And I think really important here to keep in mind is that our Constitution does something, I think, quite brilliant. It insulates our federal judges. It gives them protection from politics. It gives them lifetime tenure, so job protection, and salary protections. And in giving them those protections, it enables them to act as an independent check on political actors. They can act as an independent check without fearing that removal, that being fired, that fear is hanging over their head. They don't have that fear hanging over their head, the same way that Sally Yates did when she stepped forward on Monday and said, "I will not defend this order," and it resulted in her firing.
Great. So to be clear then, although a president, and here President Trump, nominates people to the courts, those judges and justices are then protected from the president at that point.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. But of course, that's not true of many of the president's other appointments, including appointments of people to run a number of very important agencies, the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the Environmental Protection Agency. Those appointees generally serve at the pleasure of the president, which means that he has the power to fire them if he disagrees with something they are doing. Now, one of the most controversial of President Trump's recent appointments has been that of Jeff Sessions to run the Department of Justice. Trevor, as our expert on criminal law, what does the Department of Justice do? And can you explain why this particular appointment has been so controversial?
Sure. So let me start with a brief description of the Department of Justice. As many of you know, the Department of Justice, also known as DOJ, is a federal agency. It's principally charged with investigating and prosecuting violations of the federal law. The Department of Justice has about 60 subdivisions, including the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Civil Rights Division. Now, the second question is a bit more complicated, speaking specifically about the controversy around Senator Sessions' appointment or nomination. It might be helpful to start by talking about the support for Senator Sessions. He is a longtime senator from Alabama. He served in that capacity for several decades. He ran unopposed in Alabama in 2014. He has a long track record of public service. He used to be the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Alabama. But turning to the controversial elements of his nomination, A lot of people have questioned his ability to relate to minority populations, his policies, his stances with respect to minority populations. Well, what am I talking about specifically? If we go all the way back to Senator Sessions' tenure as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Alabama, he took a number of controversial positions with respect to voting rights. He specifically prosecuted three civil rights workers in 1986. And that prosecution has sort of dogged Senator Sessions' career for several decades. I just want to give you a few details about that prosecution. One of the civil rights workers, one of the three, had been working for decades to register African-American voters in Alabama. The three of them were accused of voter fraud, mail fraud. There were 29 counts to the indictment. They went to trial. Many of the counts were thrown out by the judge at trial. The remainder went to the jury, and all three were acquitted. Senator Sessions says that if we could turn back the clock, that he would again prosecute each of these individuals, and that's been very concerning to his critics. Let's fast forward to the contemporary context. Why is Senator Sessions a controversial candidate today? What has he done as senator to give people pause? Well, for one, Senator Sessions has advocated for eliminating police misconduct investigations by the Department of Justice. Senator Sessions has called these investigations disrespectful. He's called them offensive. And he says we're essentially, with these investigations by the Department of Justice, specifically the Civil Rights Division, undermining confidence in our police officers. I think President Trump sort of shares that general sentiment. He's essentially described critiques of police, these reform efforts at the federal and local levels, as being a part of a war on police. So again, that's concerning. There's an open question as to whether these pattern and practice investigations of police misconduct on the local level will continue in the Trump administration. If we were to talk about sort of the ability of Senator Sessions to eliminate or terminate these pattern and practice investigations and the consent decrees that stem from these pattern and practice investigations, it's going to be a little bit more difficult than I think he or his supporters suspect. For one thing, many of these investigations resulted in consent decrees. The Obama administration secured, I think it's 19 agreements at the local level with local governments with respect to criminal justice reform and local police departments. 14 of these 19 agreements were considered or are consent decrees in which a federal judge signed the decree, turning the decree from a mere agreement to a judicial order. So for those 14, with respect to those 14 consent decrees, there's really very little President Trump can do. The Department of Justice cannot sort of unilaterally terminate a judicial order. They can't unilaterally terminate these consent decrees. So I think we can have confidence that for people who support the consent decrees, who support these federal efforts at local criminal justice reform, we can have confidence that these agreements will remain in place. However, for cities like Baltimore, other cities around the country in which the investigations are open, in which the consent decrees have not yet been signed, I think it's very likely that the tentative agreements that have been forged will be terminated. I think it's also very likely that we will not, from this point forward, under a Trump administration, under Jeff Sessions' tenure at the DOJ, see additional investigations of local police departments that have been found to be violating local residents' civil rights in a systematic fashion. I want to put one more issue on the table, one more issue with respect to presidential power under a Trump administration, under Jeff Sessions' DOJ, and that's the issue of the federal marijuana prohibition. As many of you know, as some of you may know, Senator Sessions is not a fan of marijuana. He's made a number of remarkable statements about marijuana. Among other things, he said, back in his hearings back in the 1980s, he was nominated, to be a federal judge by Ronald Reagan. There were a number of witnesses who talked about racially charged statements he had made when he was operating in the Southern District of Alabama. But I think one of the more interesting comments he was alleged to have made is that he was okay with the KKK until he found out they smoked marijuana. And that's testimony on the record in Senator Sessions' hearing. Now, he denies having made that statement, but he has made some curious statements about marijuana. He said in a Senate, I believe it was the Judiciary Committee, he said that, in his estimation, good people do not smoke marijuana. And he's taken the Obama administration to task. By name, he's mentioned President Obama, he's mentioned Attorney Generals Loretta Lynch and Eric Holder, as well as FBI Director James Comey, saying they all have sort of abdicated their responsibilities as part of the executive branch specifically in enforcing marijuana decriminalization, in failing to enforce the federal marijuana prohibition and decriminalization states. So let me just wind down by saying that I do think the federal government, DOJ, Jeff Sessions, is going to be very aggressive about prosecuting marijuana production, distribution, and decriminalization states. And I think that's important. There will be a clash between the federal government and I think high-profile producers and distributors in decriminalization states. Let me sort of add a few points to that. This is not going to be an easy task for the federal government. Well, why is that? A couple things. One, it's important to note that the federal government does not have the ability to direct state and local police, right? It cannot issue directives, commands to state and local police. Well, why is that important? There are about 1.2 million law enforcement agents across the country. Only 80,000 of them are operating at the federal level. That means in order for the federal government to broadly enforce something like the federal marijuana prohibition, it needs the cooperation of state and local police. It often comes in on the back end after local police have made arrests for marijuana production, distribution, trafficking, and prosecutes, the DOJ will prosecute on the back end. But you know, our local police are doing a lot of that work. So in the event that Sessions, the DOJ, does not have that cooperation, it's gonna be, again, difficult for them to prosecute, enforce the federal marijuana prohibition broadly in decriminalization states. So I want to make that point. I want to make the point that local governments still matter. They matter quite a bit in criminal enforcement, in federal criminal enforcement. And if local governments matter, that means local democracies matter. That means every person who participates in local governance matters, because you eventually dictate exactly what your police are going to be able to do, the extent to which they can participate in these criminal enforcement initiatives at the federal level, and I think that's important. And I'll add one last point. The idea of public safety, the concept of public safety and public security, it's increasingly politically contested, right? For several decades, we sort of assumed that there was solidarity with respect to public security, public safety. That's no longer the case. If you look at immigrant sanctuary, if you look at marijuana decriminalization, local governments, local populations are increasingly rising up and offering their own sense of what public safety means, and as well as the means to public safety. And so I think we should all sort of take that to heart as we consider our prospects, for the next 4 to 8 years.
Thank you. So one thing I just wanted to underscore, it sounds like what you're saying is that even when we have a strong federal government, state and local governments still really matter.
They absolutely matter. They matter because the federal government, again, cannot control state and local police. They matter because state and local police outnumber federal law enforcement agents by a ratio of about 10 to 1. All of those elements, statistics, constitutional provisions, jurisprudence, they're all relevant, and they make local populations, local governments, local democracies that much more important to federal criminal enforcement.
Thank you. So another place where we see this interplay between the federal government and state or local governments is in the is with respect to what are called sanctuary cities. So Angelica, you're our expert in immigration law. Can you explain what is a sanctuary city, and is Seattle a sanctuary city?
I can try.
Thank you.
So there's no legally settled definition of what constitutes a sanctuary city, but the phrase has been used to refer to cities that take a very wide range of actions to protect immigrants that include declining to spend local resources assisting with immigration enforcement, offering city services without respect to immigration status, refusing to detain immigrants for immigration officials, protecting confidential records, preventing local officials from asking about or investigating immigration status, and even providing access to legal counsel for immigrants facing deportation. So Seattle is taking several of these steps and considers itself, or at least seems to consider itself, a sanctuary city as of now.
And President Trump already has taken some steps to crack down on sanctuary cities. So can you help us understand, what can President Trump do to crack down on sanctuary cities, and how can he do it?
Sure. So first, it's important to point out that local jurisdictions have no legal obligation to assist with civil immigration enforcement, which is a responsibility of the federal government, not of local governments. So a local decision to offer resources to federal immigration enforcement is completely voluntary, and in some sense, it is actually lending local resources to what's really a federal government responsibility. So non-cooperation with a federal government in this case could be critiqued on policy grounds, but it's rarely a clear violation of federal law. In fact, the opposite has proven to be true. In terms of legal violations, many jails that have detained people and held them on the request of immigration authorities have been held liable for violating those people's constitutional rights. Nevertheless, of course, we saw in one of last week's executive orders the president threatening to cut funding for so-called sanctuary cities. However, the president's move to try to force local communities to carry out the work of federal immigration authorities is likely to violate principles, again, of local control, which say that the federal government cannot order cities around directly. Also, the threat to cut off the funding stands on pretty shaky legal ground. The same Supreme Court decisions that we saw on state and local power that red states rely to block Democratic initiatives will be relied on now by sanctuary cities and states to try to block the Trump administration. So ironically, it's those decisions that might prove helpful now. If the Trump administration tries to withdraw money from cities for refusing to affirmatively help federal immigration authorities, that withdrawal of funds under current case law will have to be pretty limited in scope, and even then it might be unconstitutional. So as long as cities avoid affirmative interference with federal immigration enforcement activities, the national government will probably be quite limited in the amount of punishment it can dole out. One other limitation, of course, will be the financial one. So Catherine's already mentioned the cost of the wall and the difficulties of actually carrying that out because of the finances. If President Trump wanted to follow through with the sanctuary cities and other immigration-related orders he signed last Wednesday, it would require 150,000 prison beds to house immigrant detainees, and that's nearly five times as many as are currently available now. And the estimated cost alone for that would be about $8 billion.
So does all of this mean that individuals who are in the country illegally can't be deported as long as they're in Seattle?
No, definitely not. So first, it's important to understand that the simple fact of being undocumented under the immigration law means you're subject to being placed in deportation proceedings, and that many Seattle residents are already actively facing deportation proceedings just about a mile away from here in the immigration court here in Seattle. So the question is, for those folks in Seattle who have not yet come to the attention of immigration authorities, even living in a city like Seattle with protections for immigrants may not be sufficient from them to stop from being in deportation proceedings or stop from ending up in deportation proceedings. The Trump administration has very clear deportation goals that were laid out in one of last week's executive orders. The priority for deportation is purportedly quote-unquote criminals, but the executive order defines this category so broadly that, at least in my opinion, pretty much all of the 11 million or so undocumented people in the U.S. are now a priority for deportation. So in a sense, there are no priorities because everyone is now a priority. So the question then becomes, how will undocumented people end up facing deportation? I see the executive orders of this past week as a signal to immigration officers on the grounds that pretty much any tactics they want to pursue are now fair game. And so this new executive order saying that every undocumented person is a priority for deportation means that we're likely to see a broadening of immigration enforcement practices, some of which had already been abandoned. So for example, the workplace raids that the Obama administration had basically stopped are likely to return, and we'll see a ramping up of raids that have been ongoing throughout the Obama administration. So raids on people's homes and neighborhoods are likely to ramp up. And there may be limited things that city officials can do to stop ICE officers from going to people's homes or to their workplaces. But again, despite or maybe because of that, state and local governments will continue to be incredibly important if they wish to be a line of defense for immigrants. We already see this happening. So San Francisco already filed a lawsuit, perhaps preemptively suing the Trump administration for its threats against sanctuary cities. Los Angeles, we saw taking a different tack yesterday, and again, all of this is happening in real time, with its city council announcing that it's going to be decriminalizing street vending, knowing that the misdemeanors that immigrant street vendors get charged with can make them vulnerable to deportation. So they're taking a decriminalizing tack. And locally here, just this week, the Seattle City Council passed a welcoming city resolution, which among other things calls for the development of a strategy to create and fund a legal defense fund for those Seattleites who do end up facing deportation. So these innovative legal and policy strategies will be more important than ever.
Thank you. So we're starting to see a theme here, which is that the president has an enormous amount of power, but it's not limitless. And this becomes clear when we look to the role that state and local governments play. And it also becomes clear when we look to the role that Congress out in Washington, D.C. plays. As Catherine explained, for the president to act, he often needs Congress to go along with him. Now, this brings us to Sally, our expert in healthcare law. And Sally has particular expertise in the ACA, which is also known as Obamacare. So Sally, let me ask you this. What the heck is going on with Obamacare?
What is going on with Obamacare? What's happening is that the Republican majority in Congress is having a very, very difficult time agreeing on a replacement for the Affordable Care Act. And the reasons are both political and practical. So the Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration have said that they will not pull the rug out from under the 20 million people who gained coverage in the past 3 years. And they've promised to maintain the pre-existing condition protections. And they've promised to reduce healthcare costs that are borne by individuals and by families. And these are all really popular promises. They are also extremely tough to square with a commitment to reducing federal regulation, reducing federal spending, and turning to a more free market approach. Because the ACA is already a very conservative, very free market oriented approach. So it would probably be easier to meet these promises by moving towards a more of a single-payer Medicare-type system or towards actually like more regulation and more subsidies. So that said, there are proposals out there. And there are two prominent ones from Representative Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House, and from Tom Price, who is the proposed nominee for Secretary of Human Services. So these two proposals and similar ones that are out there would have impacts throughout the healthcare system, including employer-provided insurance and also Medicare. But I thought I'll just talk for a couple of minutes about a handful of key provisions in these as they relate to Medicaid and to the marketplaces. So first, both these proposals would repeal the requirement that people have insurance, and they would repeal the requirement that big businesses provide it. Secondly, they would fundamentally change Medicaid. So they would cut back on or entirely eliminate the Medicaid expansion for working-age, low-income people, and they would convert the entire program to either a block grant or a per capita cap, and for with less federal funding. And in return, states would get flexibility, but what they would get flexibility to do realistically is to eliminate the entitlement to Medicaid, or cut back on who's covered, or time limits, or cut back on coverage. I mean, this is a really important deal. It's a very big deal. There are about 75 million people who are covered by Medicaid right now, and that includes some of our most vulnerable citizens. It includes low-income people over age 65, and low-income people with disabilities. So that's certainly something to watch for, what happens with the Medicaid program. Third, these proposals would change the subsidies. So right now, if you purchase insurance on the marketplaces, if you don't get it through an employer, you might be able to get premium subsidies. And under the ACA, these are sliding scale, and they're income-based. And they max out at about 400% of the poverty level. So for an individual who makes $50,000, they are not eligible for any premium subsidies. About 80% of those who do buy on the marketplaces do get premium subsidies. So how these proposals would change that is to make them age-based and flat. So a 50-year-old who makes $300,000 a year would get the same subsidy as a 50-year-old who makes $8,000 a year. So they'd be flat. These proposals also do away with another important type of subsidy, and that's the cost-sharing reductions. So as you might know, the out-of-pocket costs can be very high on any insurance plan, including these. The ACA has cost-sharing reductions for people who are low to moderate income. And these proposals would do away with those and substitute instead what are known as health savings accounts. So in general, how they would work is the federal government would make, say, a one-time payment of like $1,000 to your savings account. And then you could add to it with pre-tax dollars and make it bigger. And the idea is that people would have higher out-of-pocket costs, but they could turn to these savings accounts to help meet them. And the savings accounts are tax favored, which of course is not that useful if you're in a low tax bracket or you don't pay taxes. So we'll hear a lot about health savings accounts. The fourth thing I wanted to mention is that the proposals would bring back pre-existing condition consideration for some people. So instead of an individual requirement to have insurance, the idea is you would face the threat that if you had a gap in coverage, if you didn't have continuous coverage, then you could be charged more based on your health status or have other consequences to your coverage. And to help people who were rated based on a pre-existing health status, these plans would encourage states to set up high-risk pools and would have some kind of federal money to encourage the states to do that. It's really pretty unclear how these would work or how much money they would need from federal or state governments. So before the ACA, a number of states had these. The high-risk pools were generally quite small. I think I read that in the whole country, there were like 200,000 people on them. And they were expensive, and they tended to have a wait list to get into them. So, and then one last point I wanted to mention about these various proposals we want to keep an eye out as the plans go forward is that they would allow a much wider variety of insurance plans to be sold. So the ACA requires that all plans cover what are known as the 10 essential health benefits. It requires coverage of preventative care without copay and without coinsurance. And it requires that the plans have a backstop for how much money you'd have to pay any year out of pocket for in-network coverage, and a variety of other patient protections. So instead, the replacement proposals would probably require just a basic catastrophic coverage, or would just defer to whatever the states wanted to require. So related to that, these replacement proposals would allow a wider age band. And so what that means in practice is that people in their 20s would pay less than they are now, and people in their 50s and early 60s before Medicare would pay more. So it stretches it out. And so all these different variables This is what underlies the idea to allow purchasing insurance across state lines. Because the idea is some states would lightly regulate, so you could buy a low coverage, catastrophic, very high deductible plan from a state that allowed that, and it'd be much less expensive than a state that had required robust coverages and financial protections. So these are just a few of the key issues to watch for as the replacement debate unfolds in Congress. So overall, my sense is these proposals would reduce federal spending, and they would reduce federal regulation. They would shift costs and responsibilities onto the states and onto individuals and families. And compared to the ACA, the repeal proposals would tend to be better for those who are really good at paperwork, and better for those who are healthier, and also better for those who are wealthier.
The University of Washington School of Law and Town Hall Seattle hosted this event, Presidential Power in 2017, on February 1st. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon.